Well, good evening and welcome to the Trinity Fellowship events tonight. We are glad that you are here. Thank you for braving the cold and the rain and the mist. You're a hearty bunch to be here tonight. This is the third Trinity Fellowship event that we've had this semester, but Trinity Fellowship is a fairly new venture. So if you give me just a moment to explain a little bit about what the Trinity Fellowship is and what we intend to do, I'd appreciate that. Trinity Fellowship is a cross ministry resource for the IU community, bringing multiple Christian traditions together. It's not an extension of any one particular campus ministry. It's meant to be a resource for all campus ministries. It's intended to reach across and serve students of campus ministries, or, frankly, students who aren't a part of any campus ministry. Moreover, the Trinity Fellowship strives to bridge multiple Christian traditions, welcoming participation and input from Catholic, Orthodox believers, and Protestants of every stripe. Here at the IU community, we strive to bring together faith and learning. Too often, these two things exist in silos, we believe, to the detriment both of our faith and to our learning. We strive to discover the intellectual resources of the Christian faith and equip students for contemporary life. We desire to engage in honest inquiry with academic integrity to discuss questions while remaining humble in our conclusions. We strive to promote theological curiosity and contribute to the common good. We strive to avoid activities that divide us from the very campus culture we seek to serve, to create an environment that affirms Christian truth claims and is generous to those who differ from us. If you'd like to learn more about who we are or what we have scheduled, we invite you to visit our website, tfiu.org. Also, follow us on social media, and if you would please sign up for the email list. There is a table and a clipboard in the back where you can get regular emails about what is upcoming. Tonight, we are here to discuss the question, truth claims in a pluralistic culture. The world we live in, the discussions we have, even the way we think, has changed over the past 50 years, in part because the world has shrunk. We live amidst, converse with, and are shaped by a plurality of cultures, worldviews, and philosophies, informal and formal. In this cultural environment, I think we all feel a tension regarding truth and making claims to know truth. It can feel arrogant, unkind, and offensive to make truth claims. But can we really give them up? If not, how do we proceed in this culture to make and defend claims to truth? That's the task of the panel tonight. Each panelist will tackle two main questions. First, are truth claims necessary? If they're offensive, divisive, can we just leave them aside? If not, second question, how do we make and defend truth claims in today's world? The panel will be approaching these questions from different disciplines. One from the discipline, the study of philosophy, one as a pastor theologian, and the third as a scientist. Dr. Tim O'Connor is a philosopher whose chief interests lie in metaphysics, philosophy of the mind, and philosophy of religion. He's taught at Indiana University for more than 20 years, and this past year he decided to unleash his inner cowboy and move to Texas, where he's teaching at Baylor University. Dr. O'Connor received an MA in philosophy from the University of Illinois at Chicago and his PhD in philosophy from Cornell University. Dr. John Beggs is professor of physics here at Indiana University, where he's taught since 2005. He received his BS and master degree from Cornell University and his PhD from Yale University. In addition, Dr. Beggs did postdoctoral work at the National Institute of Health. Dr. Bob Whitaker is a pastor and a theologian. In addition to his teaching work at Evangelical Community Church, he has been a member of the adjunct faculty of Ivy Tech State College. He's also a member of the adjunct faculty at Indiana University. He received an MA from Trinity Law School, an MDiv and an STM from Yale University, as well as a DMin from Princeton Theological Seminary. Each panelist will present for 10 minutes. We'll see how that goes. And then there will be a robust time of Q&A afterwards. Thank you very much, panelists.
I hope you agree, John.
Oh, okay. All right, that's fine. I'm happy to go first.
Yeah.
So I'm the scientist in the bunch, and I think if I were to ask the question, why is it proper or necessary to make truth claims in science? Well, it's definitely expected. So when we do science, the goal is that you're going to come up with an answer. There is one mass for the hydrogen atom. It's not your mass and my mass and somebody else's mass over there. There is one mass. So in that sense, science tends to be something that believes that truth is out there, and it's our job to find it. It's not in here. It's not something we construct. And when we go find it, we try to prove that what we've got, at least as best we can, is something that a large number of reasonable people will agree with. So there should be consensus within the scientific community. There's lots of examples of this type of thing. I mean, certainly when it comes to measuring fundamental constants, you can have that, like the large gravitational constant, the mass of the hydrogen atom, if you wanted to do that, the charge to mass ratio of the electron, et cetera. You can just go on and on with that sort of stuff. That said, what I've just given you, though, is the standard picture of science. There are times when it's a little bit messier than that. Okay? Just for amusement and discussion, let me mention a few things. So when people do go to measure constants, what happens is one lab will measure a constant. Let's just say this is some axis, and we measure it at this value. The next lab that measures that constant will probably measure it almost at the same value, and then the next lab. And then somebody else will come in down here. And then after they measure it at a very drastically different value, the next people who measure it will measure it at the same value at this new group. Okay? And people often wonder, well, why is that going on? There's many theories about why people do that kind of stuff, but here's one possible explanation, one that's offered most often. What happens is when somebody does the first measurement, it's probably wrong by some certain amount. Okay? But the next group, when they go out to tune their equipment and make the measurement, what they do is they run it first and they go, oh, we're very far away from what they published. Let's run it again. They run it again. They go, oh, we're still far away. Let's tune this and fiddle this. And then they get an answer that's really close to the published value and they go, oh, now everything's good. So this is something called confirmation bias. It can sneak into science. And you can say, okay, now we're not going to mess with our equipment anymore because it's giving something in agreement with what somebody else published. And then it'll take a few years before someone comes along and goes, wait a minute, the equipment was all off, we really got to check this, and so forth. That kind of stuff can go on in science. But the idea is that usually it gets found out. Usually we have to build things with our scientific ideas. Usually planes either fly or they don't. And based on such things, we have to conform with an external reality. So what I would say is that, by and large, science views itself as it's absolutely necessary to make truth claims. We do experiments. We come to some sort of consensus with it. There are little occasional blips where people don't agree and there's controversy and so forth. But by and large, in the long run, scientists tend to agree on what things are there. It's not really possible for someone to say, I have a separate truth and maybe that's your truth and this is my truth. In the end, it should all be settled by experiment. We believe in experiments so strongly that certain branches of science right now that don't have contact with experiment are starting to get doubted by many people. One of these areas you might have heard of is called string theory, and it's very elegant. It's a very fundamental form of physics that tries to explain why the laws of physics are the way they are. The problem with this theory is it's not very easy to test it. It's extremely difficult right now. We don't have the power, the energy, the apparatus to do it, and we might never have the appropriate apparatus to test this theory. In that sense, many scientists are saying, should we continue to invite people to create more string theories? Should we really invest in this? There's a lot of doubt right now. And over the past 20 years, many people have become increasingly skeptical of string theory. So this might be an example of, you know, the point that I'm trying to make, which is ultimately scientists must conform to the external reality. That external reality is unitary. It's not pluralistic. It's something that we all have to come to agree on. In string theory, if it can't make contact with experiments, which is the primary way which we validate things, it's probably going to disappear after a while. I think I want to mention just a couple of other really quick points on this. We should make a distinction between different theories in science and different methods. Okay, so different theories would be, I think the Earth is flat versus I think the world is round. Or I think the Earth is at the center of the solar system, or the Sun is at the center of the solar system. Those are different theories. Different methods happen all the time in science. I happen to do neuroscience and physics, and so I'm constantly blending methods from these two different disciplines. And so there's going to be different viewpoints that people have. That's not really what we're talking about here. At least that's not what I'm talking about. There's sometimes where one theory, let's say Newtonian physics, will be superseded by another theory, Einsteinian physics, relativity. But in that case, it's not really commonly said by physicists that Newton was flat out wrong. He did an excellent job, but the fundamental truth of what he said was not correct, and Einstein did a better job of explaining things. Under most circumstances, you can't tell the difference between the two theories. So again, I think there's some consensus about what is right. Yes, Einstein has a different view from Newton, but people at this point appeal to experiments, and relativity has been held up again and again and again. The only place where I could kind of think about two theories coexisting that really aren't compatible would be in an area called quantum mechanics. And there, we're talking about particles and other things that are very, very small. And when they're very small, they don't behave according to our normal intuitions. And in that realm, you could say, in a sense, there are two theories going on. One is a theory that when things get really, really small, they behave like a wave. So little pieces of light, photons, they behave like waves. When you pass them through a little grating, they show properties like waves. You can bend them. They have spectral properties. There's lots of stuff that makes it look like they have waves as the best descriptor for what they are. But when you come to little particles of light, the photons, they also behave like little billiard balls in some sense. They're like little particles. And there's some experiments where you can do, and it looks like the best way to explain it is they're little particles. And other experiments that you can do where the best explanation looks to be that they're waves. Physicists have come to live with this and feel happy about it, but I think nobody really feels that this is at the state where we feel comfortable with it. We'd love it if someone came along and said, this is why it looks that way there and that way there. Someone would go, oh, thank you. Oh, wow, that's really resolved things. So people like Niels Bohr, who did a lot in quantum mechanics, he said, anyone who thinks they understand quantum theory is basically blabbering. They don't know what they're talking about. So even the people who constructed quantum theory have lots of problems with it. Does that mean that reality is fundamentally pluralistic? Maybe not. It might just mean that we haven't gone far enough to actually see the fundamental underlying reality of it. So I would present this basic, I'll end on this basic picture of science, which is that, yeah, we're pretty much in the camp of there is an external reality, and if you do your experiments properly, and if you get a lot of people together, and we have some sort of consensus, then that's our best grasp at what the truth is. And in the long run, science has a remarkably good track record for producing good technology, medical advances, things like that. So probably of all the branches of stuff that's going on at the university, people would point to science and say, oh, that's a clean discipline. I know it's seedy underbelly, that there's other problems with it, but yeah, that's the reputation, and who am I to dissuade you of that, right? I mean, I'd like you to continue to think that's good. So maybe I'll state that position as perhaps a straw man that could be knocked down or more conversation, but essentially, yeah, it's proper for us to do it. We've got a way of doing it by experiment and consensus.
All right. Hey, how y'all doing? Y'all doing all right? All right. So what I thought I would, sorry if you walked in late, there was a little Texas intro on that. So I thought I'd start off, there are three things I wanted to say. The first is just to address the reason why people feel uncomfortable in with the idea that there might be truth that some people have and other people lack in areas that are divisive, right? Like religion or ethics or politics. And of course, that reason is that we value, or we think we ought to value, political and social tolerance and respect for other people, right? And I say, good, yes, we need more of that. But it, and we also just ought to recognize that you know, members of other religions, whatever our religious viewpoint is, members of other religion or no religion at all. There are some such members that have valuable things to contribute to society. They have virtue, they have wisdom, just like some, not all, members of your own religion do. right? And I think that's true also, and it's important to recognize that in a kind of pluralistic culture that we live in. But it doesn't follow from that that all religious claims are true or false, or my religion might be true for me and yours is true for you. They're just inherently subjective truths, and there's no objective truth of the matter. And of course, then the reply, if you say it doesn't follow that there's no truth, is, but yeah, but it's arrogant, right? It would be arrogant to think that have tentatively uncovered some kind of truth that other people, at least some of whom, have looked at the same kind of considerations that you would point to as favoring what you believe, they've drawn different conclusions, right? And so you must be arrogant. You must think that somehow you reason better than they do, or you have access to special information that they lack, and maybe it's because you're favored by God or some such thing, right? But this is the word people think, that it's inherently arrogant to be committed, to have commitments that other people of goodwill and intelligence and having access to information don't share. And I have a twofold response to that. The first is, really, do we want to say that all religious people are inherently arrogant? That's the vast majority of people on the planet that have ever lived, right, have been religious in some form or other, right? And sure, there are a lot of arrogant religious people because, there's a lot of people, and arrogance is, there's a healthy dose of arrogance about among human beings. But it's not inherent. We all know, surely, religious, devout religious people who are not arrogant. And then the second thing is to say, think about, and this is the philosopher, okay, I'll put on my philosopher hat. Let's think about the how the person's reasoning who thinks that it would be arrogant. They're thinking something like, well, if you believe something, and you're aware of the fact that other reasonable people having access to similar information that you have come down differently, and yet you insist that your way of seeing things is correct, or you think it's correct, then you must be arrogant, right? That's what they're thinking. But then consider that very view, right? The view that says this is what you're supposed to do in the face of disagreement, withhold, right? Don't be committed to any particular view. That's a disputed claim. Most people actually don't think that that's the right way to proceed, right? So it seems like it's pretty arrogant, right, for the person to embrace that principle, right? But then it becomes self-defeating, right, to you, because now you're embracing this principle that, by your own lights, is arrogant, right? Because not everyone accepts that kind of principle about what to do in the face of disagreement, right? And the lesson here is just that it's inescapable that you're going to take some kind of stand or other, right? And there's no kind of position that you can take that is somehow immune to rational criticism, right? That people can't raise questions reasonably about and ask you why you think that. Think about the old parable. I think it's ultimately an Indian parable about the three blind men and the elephant, right? Three blind men, they all touch the elephant, but a different part of the elephant. The one who touches the broad side of the elephant, says, this is what we're confronting here is a great painting canvas, and the other person touches one of the legs of the elephant and says, no, it's a tree, right? And the other one, the trunk of the elephant, says it's a great snake, right? And of course, the story is, we're invited to kind of smile and say, they all got part of the truth, right? But they are foolishly supposing they're grasping the whole thing. Okay? But what we rarely do is say, who's telling us this story, right? Well, it's the person who's saying, who's inviting us to imagine ourselves. We're not blind. We're thinking about these poor, benighted, blind people, and we see the whole picture. The picture is that all religions are partly true, and they kind of fit together in some kind of way so that only collectively that they have the truth. Well, that's a really big claim about reality. If it's true, I want to believe that. How do you know that? Right? Where do you come by this magical perspective where you get to see that this is so, right? You could maybe try to argue for that kind of claim, but then you're going to just do what people who are either religious or not religious will do, is just give reasons, right? So it's not fun, right, for us to live in a context where we find ourselves in disagreement with people that we respect, who draw different conclusions and sometimes debates get a little bit heated, and that's just the human condition, right? And there just is no kind of Olympian perspective, you know, up in the clouds, above it all, above the fray, such that that's the reasonable point of view, and you get that view for free. You don't have to argue for that kind of perspective. There just is no such position, right? Final thing I wanted to say is that believing that there are truths out there to be found, whether we find them or not, I think actually promotes civility. Right, and I think a lot of people think no. It's just the opposite. We got too many ideologically committed people, right? And that promotes. And that's where you get war, right? It just almost goes as a unspoken but obvious truth in our culture that religion is at the source of a lot of war, right? The religion is that, you know, it's a John Lennon imagine there was no religion. Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Because, you know, it'd be all love and harmony, right? Fact of the matter is, there's an anthropologist, very distinguished guy, Scott Atran. He's completely secular, has no religious commitment whatsoever, but he actually studies religion as a natural phenomenon, right? Because religion is a cross-cultural universal. So he studies religion, and he recently wrote a lengthy article excerpted from a book of his, I think you can find it online, where he tries to do kind of an exhaustive study of historical sources and classify wars in human history, all the ones we know about, and to what extent that they have a significant religious component behind them. The figure he came up with was perhaps 7%. Right? Perhaps 7% of all human wars had some kind of significant religious component. And in fact, he said, and again, he's a completely non-religious individual himself, he said he thinks the evidence indicates that Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, particularly discourage, have a kind of discouraging, dampening effect on the very natural, unfortunately, human impulse towards warring and aggression that we all have. It's part of our nature. Because of this overarching commitment of the Abrahamic religions that we are all creatures, right? We're all children of the same God. Not to say that religious people, including religious Christians, don't sometimes give religious justifications, but it's a myth to think that religion is one of the driving forces of war. Now, this is just something endemic to being human. Sometimes it gets co-opted in a religious context, but religions often play the evidence indicates a dampening kind of role on that very impulse. And, you know, look around you today, right? We live in a culture where it's increasingly common for people, even, you know, kind of educated, sophisticated people, to say things like, you know, there's just no truth to be had, right? And what does that kind of attitude promote? And I think what we're seeing in our culture is a tendency towards being polarized, being distrustful of others, just saying, you know what, you just can't reason with these people, you just shun them, and ideally, you know, you have power, get our groups, people who think like us, into power, and just ostracize these other sorts of people. And so I don't think it's actually leading to a kind of more accepting, more tolerant kind of attitude. So I think what we need to do is to rediscover the virtues of kind of reasoned dialogue among equals in a kind of civic context, and it's hard. And most of us don't do that consistently all the time, but you can get better at it. And so I think that's the only way forward, unfortunately, is to recognize that we live together, we cohabit together, and if we understand that there are truths out there, if we operate with that understanding, then if we have at least a modicum of humility, we're going to say, you know what, maybe I need to listen to these other individuals because maybe they have access to information I don't have. And then that thrusts us together into a communal project. I mean, science is a, you know, spectacular example of this kind of thing, of a cooperative enterprise. It's just not possible to make great progress as an individual in science. It's necessarily a communal enterprise. Even the great figures, people like Einstein, rarely do you even see these kind of figures having this towering influence anymore. It's just too complex, massively distributed. It's masses of teams of people. And if we see ourselves in culture around the more difficult to adjudicate issues of religion and ethics, as working together cooperatively well, then I think we can make some progress. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim and John. So how about if we just stop, because I'm not sure there's anything left to say. You know, they put it all together for us. No, I'm supposed to bring a perspective of someone who is perhaps distinctively religious, because my vocation is to be a pastor and a lay theologian to that extent. So my comments come from that tradition. So I begin with the first question. The first question is, why are truth claims necessary? Are they? If so, why? The first reason I would suggest that truth claims are necessary is because they're virtually unavoidable, right? In terms of the average conversations that you have any day, intelligible, constructive dialogue, it almost always includes some form of a truth claim. Now, you may not think it does, but if you analyze your speech, you'll find out that more often than not, it does. Or, for instance, by way of example, if you feel like you don't make too many truth claims or none in a given day, listen to the news, whatever your news feed is, or read whatever your source of news is, and see if you can determine how many articles are written without reference to any form of truth claim, right? You won't find it, because it's part of constructive dialogue, and I think it's an important part of constructive dialogue. So why are truth claims necessary? Because I think they're really quite unavoidable. Second reason I think truth claims are necessary, particularly from my perspective as a religious leader, it seems to me that truth claims are actually embedded in the nature of religion itself. In other words, to be involved in any religious practice or in any religious dialogue or in any religious community, you have to have accepted or affirmed a truth claim in order to really be a part of that religion. It just comes with the territory. For instance, a perfect example, simple example of this would be if you said God exists, right? That's a truth claim, okay? Just made a truth claim, God exists. There are very few religions that I know of who would deny that that truth claim is false. They may have different views on that truth claim. As a matter of fact, many religions might say there are more than one God. Some religions would say there is only one God. The point is, to be a part of religious community, it's almost inevitable that you accept a truth claim of some sort or another. It could be a widely divergent truth claim compared to some other religions, but you're probably going to accept some sort of truth claim in order to be in religious community or religious dialogue. The third thing I think is the reason that it's necessary to make truth claims from my perspective. And again, I come from a distinctively Christian perspective, obviously, with my vocation and my personal convictions. Christianity, as a matter of fact, it must make truth claims. In other words, to be a Christian, there is an inherent demand that you accept truth claims and that you make them. So if you're going to be a Christian, you first have got to accept the words of Jesus. And he made multiple truth claims. I am the way, the truth, and the life for one, right? And there are many others. So in order for me to enter into the Christian religion, I have to accept the truth claims made by another, namely Jesus Christ. But there's more to that than just the accepting of the truth claim. That's why I say it's necessary to make the truth claim. I have to not only accept the truth claim, but if I'm going to be a Christ follower, I actually have to proclaim the truth claim, right? In other words, I have to accept the words of Jesus, and then I have to take it as my responsibility, being a Christ follower, a disciple, to reproduce the truth claims of Jesus. Or, to put it another way, in the words of Jesus, I need to go into all the world and proclaim the gospel, share the gospel with everyone. In order to share the gospel with everyone, it's inevitable that I have to reproduce the truth claims of Jesus. So first, I think truth claims are unavoidable. Second, I think they're embedded in the nature of religion, even if it's not Christianity. Third, it seems to me that Christianity demands truth claims of its adherents. And fourth, I would note that whether it is Christianity or other religions, but particularly Christianity, truth claims are the basis of religious community. In order to enter into community, religious community, you accept certain truth claims. And then when you gather together in religious community for religious worship services, you represent the truth claims, either by proclamation through preaching, which is my job, or through singing, or through the reading of scripture, or through the proclamation of a creed. So it's a communal activity to take the truth claim that is yours and reproduce it for those who are followers of a particular religion. That's just the nature of religion. The second question, major question we're asked to address, is how should we express truth claims? If they're necessary, and I believe they are, and unavoidable, the question then becomes how to do this, right? What's the methodology? And I want to say something about that by using contrasting themes. It seems to me that the way to express truth claims is to, instead of thinking about the word declaration, think about the word dialogue, okay? Declaration versus dialogue. Declaration is not necessarily negative, but it does have negative overtones, especially now. Negative overtones associated with politics, negative overtones associated with fundamentalists in any religion, negative overtones with hate speech, all kinds of negative overtones that are associated with declaration. A declaration doesn't have to be necessarily negative. On the other hand, it might be helpful for those of us who embrace truth claims to move towards dialogue rather than declaration. Because when we move towards dialogue rather than declaration, we actually are in a conversation with someone else. We're inviting a person to come into a conversation to examine a truth claim that we hold dear or perhaps that they hold dear. And in that dialogue, rather than the declaratory sentence, in that dialogue, I think the possibility of real consensual truth might emerge more than through declaration. The second way, it seems that we might use our expression of religious or truth claims, and from my perspective, religious truth claims, is instead of engaging in aggressive arguments, we engage in what I'm calling charitable listening. Right? So the dialogue theme continues in point number two. Aggressive arguing, it seems to me, is basically a particular person trying to prove another person wrong, right? And sometimes, unfortunately, at any cost. Sometimes it's the truth that suffers because you want to win the argument. My suggestion is aggressive argumentation, right, as it relates to truth claims, is probably not the best approach. Perhaps the best approach is what I'm calling charitable listening. And charitable listening essentially is this. It seeks to understand the other. It seeks to get inside the mind and the heart of the other individual who is perhaps in maybe real disagreement with you. In order to get inside the mind of that person, you have to listen charitably. And as you listen charitably, two things happen. One, it becomes clear how you're different, right? Because you probably didn't understand to the depth that you needed to understand your differences. Two, you begin to understand your own perspective better. Every time I'm in charitable dialogue with another person, I learn so much, not just about them, but about me. And it helps me to understand how my truth claim ought to be shaped in public discourse. So this kind of charitable dialogue, understanding the other, entering into that conversation, seems to me one of the better ways to express truth claims. The third way I would suggest that we ought to express truth claims, those of us who think that it is necessary, is to move from arrogance to humility, right? And one way to do that, if you are like me, and you hold a lot of convictions concerning God and Jesus Christ and the Christian faith, one thing I must do if I'm going to move from arrogance to humility is to admit that my truth claim, what I'm telling you, what I actually believe, I might be wrong about it. It doesn't mean I believe it any less, but in humility I have to communicate to you that I am not infallible, that I'm seeking the truth. And as I seek the truth with a fallible mind and a sinful heart, I might be wrong. Second thing I think it's important to do if I'm going to communicate a truth claim well is that I must admit that in my history of the church I love, there are many times that we were wrong, desperately wrong. And some of those times when we were desperately wrong, we put all kinds of harm on other people. That's part of a humble dialogue when I advance a truth claim. I think a truth claim in humble, not arrogant dialogue, not argumentative, but charitable listening, not necessarily declaration, but dialogue. I think in those conversations, the truth really begins to emerge. I think this charitable dialogue has not been modeled very well by some people in my Christian tradition. I think for a long time we've been more apt to declare than to dialogue. And I think that there is real promise in dialogue. I think that two things can happen in dialogue. Number one, you can understand the differences and embrace the diversity, right? If I understand how different you are from me, then and only then can I embrace the difference well. But the second thing is, in dialogue with the person who may disagree with me, I might find common ground. Common ground from diverse perspectives that we can unite around to advance the common cause, the common good. I end with just an illustration. Over the last 8 months or so, I've been in dialogue with several religious communities in Bloomington. Not the kind of thing that people in my position heretofore have done too much of, in Bloomington at least. One of the dialogues I've been in is with a religious community named Congregation Beth Shalom. That's a Jewish congregation. The other extensive dialogue I've been in is with the Islamic Center. We don't actually have a mosque in Bloomington, but we do have an Islamic Center. And we've been in dialogue for a long period of time. In February, there's actually going to be three of us that are going to do a panel, and it's going to be at Congregation Beth Shalom. The rabbi is going to speak for 10 minutes. A representative from the Islamic congregation is going to speak for 10 minutes. And I'm going to speak for 10 minutes. And then the three of us, we're going to talk among ourselves. And then we're going to ask those who are in attendance to ask us questions. So you might wonder, what are we talking about? We're actually talking about creation care or environmental concerns. And each of us are going to give an overview of our religious tradition's perspective on environmental concerns. And then at the end of all that, we're going to say, how are we different? That's really helpful. How do we have a common cause? That's helpful as well. I think that kind of discourse is sadly needed in our community. And I hope, honestly, and this is a promo, but I hope Trinity Fellowship can be a part of that dialogue. I guess we're ready for questions, right? Yeah. Josiah's got the mic because we want to be heard. We want you to be heard, so he's going to walk around.
So can I ask a question? If anyone has something, maybe ask a question. So one of the things that really strikes me is that it seems that people are these days much more in the camp of thinking that everybody's got their own truth. Whereas it seems like, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, people believed that, oh yeah, this is true. And now there's this thought that you're really arrogant if you claim something. Has there been a shift? And if there has been a shift, what do you guys think has caused it? Why have things changed so rapidly lately? You blame it all on Nietzsche or what?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I know the exact origin of it, but I think social media
I think there's good reason to think has intensified this. You know, people who are my age, I'm slowly getting to that point where I'm starting to talk about people. Oh, this is scary. This is terrible. Okay, I'm reflecting. I'm getting older. People my age, you know, will say, we remember back at the dawn of the internet in the early 90s. I was just starting teaching here at IU. People really looked to it with promise. They're saying, wow, you know, it's going to be this great democratization of information and dialogue, right? You don't have to live in New York City to potentially be able to talk to anyone. You can live in a small town if you've got an internet connection, you know. You can potentially have access to all these conversations, perspectives, information, and it's going to be great. And we're all just going to become so much better informed and so much smarter, and yeah. That didn't happen, did it? And one thing that people have been studying this, and they've learned some things, and what tends to happen is people tend to gravitate towards like-minded people. And then here's the really sort of disturbing thing. When you're in discussion with people that have broadly share your opinion, you know, so say a bunch of Christians talking, you know, that have broadly similar theological commitments, or a political, you know, people that share some kind of political sentiment, you might suppose, well, you know, people influence each other, so everyone will kind of move towards the mean, the middle of that group, right? No, actually they tend to gravitate towards the extreme of that group. This has been very well documented, again and again and again. And I'm not sure they even understand why.
Yeah,
but it's exactly the opposite of what you would expect, right? If you are in dialogue consistently with people who largely share your perspective, right, there tends to be this intensification of views rather than so I think that's a factor, and it's not easy to understand how to undo that.
Yeah, mine's far less academic and no research behind it, but I'll go ahead and pontificate.
Yeah.
Conflict is sexy. It drives news broadcasts everywhere. I don't need to tell you which ones are the best at it. They're not news broadcasts anymore. They're shouting matches, right? And they attract a tremendous amount of viewership. That sounds really interesting and fascinating until it becomes interpersonal. And once it becomes interpersonal, it destroys relationships, number one. And number two, because the dialogue is so shrill and such a shouting match, it appears that there is no such thing as truth. What it appears is that everybody's got their own opinion, and they're screaming their own opinion, and whoever can sweat the most on their brow or use the best, you know, words is going to win the day. I don't know if Tim would agree with me, but we're reverting back to sophism. It's the kind of thing that Socrates would just be pulling his hair out with right now, looking at what's going on. Yeah.
Clearly need somebody who has a more hopeful, optimistic take on things to kind of balance out.
Somebody
himself.
Help us.
Yeah. Hopefully this does offer some hope. I really want to applaud your courage to stand up and really get heart to heart with, you know, the current issues that are critical today. You know, we hear so much about things that are fake as opposed to, you know, how do we determine if something was fake or not or whatever. But I think in the, probably not necessarily for this event, but a future event, would be to explore how the process that developed the truce of Westphalia emerged, because we see Luther standing and nailing his 95 points on the cathedral door, and it sets off this incredible conflict between the Catholics and these new fangled ideas. And the Catholics said, "Well, we're mighty and we're strong, and we will just crush this with our military." And after 135 years and killing off a third of Europe, everybody gave up through some type of dialogue process. And what was that? What made it possible for them to just set their conflicts to one side and move to a new direction?
All right, so we'll have somebody lecture on the Peace of Westphalia. We'll get a historian here to take that one. Dan, thanks. Yeah. got.
Oh, we have somebody. Somebody who's going to right speak up, to that. Yeah, right here.
Or whoever. Yeah.
I wasn't going to speak to that at all. Oh. I don't know about that.
You don't sound like you're on the mic.
Hello?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Seems to be close to my mouth. I'm not going to speak to that at all. I'm not a historian. But I was wondering, so all three of you have talked about truth claims and the need for truth claims, as well as how to actually go about making truth claims. But it seems to me that in our society at large, there's two different ways of looking at truth claims. So I think most people in society, in our society, would agree that some amount of truth claims are appropriate and necessary. And I think, you know, the science end of things is one example of that. But where people's hackles get up over truth claims, to me anyway, seems to be more in terms of things that are nowadays considered to be social constructs, socially constructed ideas, which are come up with sort of democratically. They just sort of emerge, and that's the way they are, and that there's not necessarily, there doesn't have to be a truth claim underpinning those sorts of ideas. So I was just wondering if you could, any of you, speak to that distinction. You've got truth claims about the way the world is fundamentally, and then you've got other things which are considered to be more socially constructed. How do you deal with that and with making truth claims about things that make morality issues, for instance?
I can start up, I guess. I think the idea in science is that, yeah, we got a method, we can establish something, and so there it is, it's true. But that doesn't mean that everything outside of science is now just total garbage and we should forget it. I think that we have to live lives under constraints of, you know, time pressure. I've got to make a decision. I've got to make a decision in my life, what moral system will I use? And even if I can't come to scientific truth, and science, by the way, is an extremely narrow way of viewing the world, but if I can't come to a scientific truth about what ethical system I should use, there's still a lot of thought that ought to go into it. And I also would say that sometimes I hear other people, or I've heard my previous self, and I've said, that's bad thought. That's incorrect thought. And I think I really loved what you said about dialogue. And I agree with that. And I hope that what we should get to is also a point where we're not afraid to say, hey, I don't think that makes sense to another person. And because I know that there have been times in the past where I've had a certain ethical system and it didn't really make sense. And I thought about it and I heard from other people, and then I kind of changed that. There isn't a scientific absolute truth when it comes to ethical systems, I would say. It's not a part of science. It doesn't get published in scientific journals. But still, we're compelled to think about it. And we're compelled to think rightly about it. And if my system has inconsistencies, it undermines itself, I should discard that. So I would love to see more dialogue, definitely in the spirit of humility, but also humility, and you probably didn't exclude this, but humility where we can critique each other in a way that's honest. I had an interesting dialogue with my nephew a little while ago, and he said, oh, all religions are basically the same. And I go, well, that can't be true. And I said, well, you know, what if I just went into the backyard and I found a flower and I said, I'm going to start worshiping that flower as God. Would you take me seriously? And he said, yeah, I would. And I thought, no, you wouldn't. And we started talking about it. And I said, you got to be able to tell me when I'm wrong. You got to be able to tell me when I've got contradictions. Even if it's not science, it can still be false. There's stuff that's out there that's false. And I think that a humble discussion of that should at least admit certain people saying, hey, I think you're wrong. Maybe I'm wrong about it, yeah, but let me lay it out on the table. I think you don't have enough evidence to back up what you've got, or I think you've got a system that's self-contradictory. So we're all compelled to live lives that involve ethical choices. We can't avoid it. And we're also, I think it's incumbent upon us to think clearly about these things.
Yeah, I was going to add something, which is, you know, it's a big claim for someone to say everything having to do with the sphere of religion and ethics is all socially constructed. Right? That's an empirical claim. It's a kind of claim that a scientist could kind of look at and have some evidence at least that we that would potentially speak to that claim. Is that true? Is that how these ideas all came about? It's all, you know, fabricated from whole cloth. None of it has to do with kind of native cross-cultural universal disposition to think certain kinds of ideas, at least at some level of generality. And actually, I think it's false, right? I think the certain very fundamental moral notions, certain basic concepts of fairness, right, we see cross-culturally in very, very young children have these notions. So sure, there's variability. And sure, it's a reasonable thought that, you know what, sometimes we over-project, right? We kind of wrap our moral convictions together with things that are almost just kind of cultural emphases that we're comfortable with. You know, if you live in New York, you know, a certain brusque, fast-paced way of living is considered perfectly acceptable. People get very offended in the South. If you interact with them that way, don't stop to say hello. You know, is that a moral, you know, a kind of deep moral difference if one of them is right, you know, about the way human beings ought to be? Or, you know, can there be, can we allow this? Sure, there can be cultural variation that people prize and feel, you know, something that they feel rather deeply, but say it's strictly not an objective moral claim. So, you know, we can be a little more nuanced, I guess is what I'm driving at. And I think most people, even, you know, it's only in the academy, I think George Orwell said, some things are so outrageous only an intellectual could possibly believe it. You know, to say something like all morality, there is no such a thing as objective good. So really, you know, Nazi Germany, you know, Soviet Russia, you know, these are not objectively bad states of affairs. Nobody thinks that, right? Even, and often people who want to say that these kinds of things want to critique our own culture. Right? They're trying to push us to be a little more critical and reflective about our own culture, but that means they think there are some things that's wrong, are wrong, but, you know, potentially critiquable, morally critiquable about our own culture. And then, you know, finally, yeah, you know, as John says, religions make a lot of claims about supernatural reality. They could all be false, right? They can't all be true, but one thing's for sure, right, is they're factual claims about reality. Either our world originates, you know, in a transcendent, you know, unsurpassably good, omnipotent, immaterial reality that is God, as traditional theistic religions claims, or it did not. That's a fact. It's hard, you know. You might worry about how do we decide that question if we're uncommitted, if we're neutral outsiders. But it's a factual claim about reality.
Yeah, Steve, I appreciate the question because you identify the fact that it gets murky, right? Strictly moral claims have morphed into socially constructed manner kinds of things, and we argue as if they are equals sometimes, or we refuse to argue about them because we think they're equals, so none of them matter. I know that happens. Yeah, philosophers say outrageous things. I mean, you know. Like David Hume saying there's no such thing as causality.
Yeah,
but he didn't run out in front of an oncoming carriage. I'll have to, no matter. It seems to me, though, I'd like to use an analogy. I know one friend of mine here may critique me at the end because he's a lawyer. But the idea of a courtroom in our judicial system, right, is for a defense attorney and a prosecutor, or, you know, two attorneys, and a judge to cross-examine witnesses, to ask questions of everybody they can. Why? To try to get to the bottom of the matter, right? And at least in terms of the philosophy of law, the idea is that really good cross-examination doesn't win cases. That's not the point. The point is, really good cross-examination allows the truth to emerge. It comes to the surface, right, after the cross-examination takes place, which is why I think charitable dialogue on every level is so strategically important, whether it happens to be socially constructed ethical norms or whether it might fall into the category of classical morality. It seems like charitable discourse about those things and rigorous, you might call it, dialogue is the only way for truth, if it's out there, to emerge, right? just one last thing. I think it was Wittgenstein that said, I think to acknowledge this is sometimes helpful in an ethical dialogue. Wittgenstein said, all ethics is essentially transcendent, or something like that. In other words, there is a category, right, of transcendent truth when you're talking about ethics. That's helpful to acknowledge, but not everybody's going to.
I just want to preface this question with saying that I'm not a cynic, even though it might sound like it. So I guess my main question is, when we're considering charitable dialogue or the idea that truth claims could establish deeper community, there should surely be some instances in which truth should not yield the dialogue, right? So it's like in the question of, let's say, human rights, right? So I think Abraham Lincoln said something to the effect in his second inaugural address that, you know, both the North and the South have the same Bible and reach different conclusions, and we're willing to fight to the last drop of blood to, you know, unite the Union under the truth, right? So what in what cases should we not yield the truth to this discourse?
I went last, but I'll,
I think we need a pastoral perspective on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, go for it. That's definitely
into you.
Well, I think I'm going to be reticent to say that truth should ever yield to dialogue. But I think I want to say that decisions concerning ethical truths should eventually yield to truth, right? So the conversation may continue, but if, let's assume for a moment that you and I and everybody in this room and everybody in the world thinks it's wrong to kill people for fun, okay? It's probably pretty safe. We can continue to have that philosophical dialogue till the cows come home, but I think it's important for us to establish a norm that at least in our conduct, we're not going to kill people for fun, right? So I think that's what I would say about it. The dialogue can continue, but the action has got to be intercepted at some point for a moral norm.
I don't have anything to add to that. I have a possible follow-up question, though, if I might.
So you already asked two questions, though. You're supposed to have all the answers, so you're asking the
question. So maybe I detected, or this just sort of sparks something in my mind, this question about free speech. So when people talk about free speech on campus, this is a really hot issue, and a lot of people would argue that we shouldn't have so-called free speech because certain types of speech are just crossing a line. It's like violating somebody's rights. It's so insulting that we shouldn't have that. And there's a tension, I guess, between the idea of this process that you're talking about where different views come clashing together, and then eventually out of that, particularly if people are empathic and learning, then the truth will come out. But under certain conditions, if the speaker is extremely volatile and divisive and insulting and so forth, that might not be something. Even if it's a contrary view, somebody would argue that it doesn't lead to anything. Were you thinking any of that at the time? Or?
I mean, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I think there's a, I should add this, I think there's a danger in dialoguing about certain things too much and pretending like no truth exists. What's the name of that famous Jimmy Stewart movie? He's the philosopher. The entire movie takes place in an apartment in New York City. Yes, The Rope. That's it. It's The Rope. The philosopher, Jimmy Stewart, has been engaged with his students concerning the notion of murder, right? Philosophically. And saying there's really nothing wrong with murder, okay? That's the idea. Well, when they are having a dinner party at Jimmy Stewart's house or somebody else's house, there is a table, ostensibly a table with a tablecloth over top of it. What nobody knows, except till the very end, Jimmy Stewart discovers, is that the body of their missing friend and student is inside a casket, which actually is the table. And they've been dialoguing with Jimmy Stewart, their philosophy professor, about the legitimacy of murder. right? And all of a sudden it dawns on him. It's an oh my God moment, right? He's in that casket. My words have had a powerful impact in a way I never intended for them to have. So I do think dialogue can be dangerous. Yeah.
Okay, let me strike a, I don't know if it's a contrary note, but just, you know, maybe a, coming at it from a slightly different direction, because you're asking, at bottom, it's a political, kind of moral question. So I'm going to express an opinion here, but of course, because it's a political, moral kind of question, people disagree about this. I'm a bit old-fashioned on this kind of thing, that I think it's really important that we, within as wide a bounds as seems reasonable, prudent, and defining that boundary is difficult because I do think there is a kind of speech that can cross a line. But it should be a wide bounds. We should allow it, but we should challenge kind of morally repugnant speech, but allow it, but in part because of the danger. I think what Bob is saying is kind of complementary to what I'm saying. You can allow too little of it, and you can allow too much. You can give it the wrong context, right? Allowing certain kind of speech to take place doesn't mean you have to kind of put it front and center before a large audience, and, you know. But if you try to suppress it altogether, and there's a certain impulse on certain college campuses to want to do this, not so much here. I've talked about this with my students back when I taught here just last term before I went down to Texas. But, you know, at some of our more elite private institutions out east, people are wrestling with this. But the reason I say there's a danger in saying just don't allow this kind of speech, a whole range of kinds of speech to take place, is that it goes underground. The thoughts don't go away, right? And those thoughts can become more extreme if they're not brought up to the full light of day and have the benefit of people saying, but wait a minute, you know? And that you can moderate people if you engage them. And if you don't engage them, then I think we're seeing, you know, people can kind of, can get together, form networks over social media and so forth, and that it kind of, it can fuel, and you can create a whole group dynamic of people feeling like they're being persecuted and so forth, and so it leads them to think their ideas are not as crazy or as in need of critique as is in fact the case. So it's a difficult question, but be careful about trying to draw the boundary lines too tightly.
Yeah, I agree, Tim. I wouldn't disagree at all. I think it was the famous jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes said that free speech doesn't extend to your right to shout fire in a crowded theater.
Yeah.
Right? So there's some parameters. Yeah.
This will be our last question.
All right.
So I'm interested in, within dialogue, because you guys have all said that's kind of like important in, when talking about truth claims, from each of your perspectives, as you all come from the, you know, the list of these prestigious schools and stuff, when you guys are having these dialogues with other people within your sort of professional sector, what kind of questions have you seen to be, I don't know, produce more fruit when talking about this on a level that with, you know, maybe with someone who would be non-accepting of the truth claim you're making. Does that make sense?
What types of questions?
Because deeper in the dialogue, I mean, really, you can't have, there's really, I mean, other tactics for, you know, talking about this, you have to talk to them. So, dialogue, so then within dialogue, then, like, what kinds of, I don't know, things have you seen to produce fruit when talking about this in a way that, with someone who doesn't, you know, share the same?
Share your, truth claim.
I think your question is really good, and I wish I were better at knowing what questions would bear more fruit. Because certainly in the business of science, we like to ask those questions, put them forward, and if they're answered one way or another by the data, then that will advance the field. And I think a lot of what I can look at and do is I'll answer the wrong question. It doesn't advance it. And then no one will pay attention to that paper. And then I'll try it again, and nobody pays it. And then suddenly I'll put out a paper, and then a lot of people cite it and look at it and so forth. And I go, wow, I wouldn't have expected that. So I think those types of things are often really hard to predict. Really good scientists have a knack for finding the question that will answer
the dispute in the field. So I think it's a skill that could be learned and cultivated. I'm certainly trying to study it in other people. I'd like to get better at it. I think it has to do with getting down to the core assumption that divides the two groups. If you can find out what that is. Sometimes there's this technical stuff out here that's not really relevant. You know, if it goes this way or that way, it doesn't cause people to fundamentally change their view. But you want to dig as deep as you can and find out, aha, if this is true, then all that has to be wrong. Those are the types of questions. They go after the fundamental things. It's like pulling the bricks out of the house rather than kind of like fixing the roof. You know, if you pull the right brick out, the whole structure can come down. And in science, that can be good. You know, you want to destroy something that wasn't correct.
So, Chris, I'm in philosophy, and we ask, you know, ethics is a branch of philosophy with the basic categories of reality, the existence of God, mind and matter, space, time. These are all philosophical kinds of questions. We ask really big questions, but we don't spend most of our time sitting around saying, all right, what should we talk about today? God. All right. You know, you argue one side, you know, they're too big, right? And there's so much that can be said about different positions on this question. So you learn to be a little more, break big questions down into sort of smaller questions that might, if resolved, help on the way towards an answer to the bigger question. And to realize that, at least in philosophy, it's typically not, when you undergo a change of view, it's not because you just went step by step by step from certain assumptions that you never rethought, right, till eventually you learned enough new information, oh, boom, at the end of the day, God exists, pops out of my, you know, step-by-step deduction. No, it's not like that. It's rather, there's different systematic ways of looking at the world. And there are reasonable people who look at the world through these different kind of systematic perspectives. And sometimes you can benefit just from spending time thinking about the world from the point of view of someone else, and why they think about it. How well does it hang together? What kinds of questions does this kind of view of the world not seem to be able to answer very well? And so for me, and I think for a lot of philosophers, the occasional shift in point of view comes from just spending a lot of time thinking about whole clusters of views that all connect into a package deal, and then coming to think, you know, actually maybe this package deal, it's got its issues. Every significant claim about reality has problems, right? The sciences, you know, we all look to the sciences as our guide for a kind of systematic rational inquiry. Any scientific theory, John can tell you this, right? Even the ones that are the best confirmed and that everyone works within in terms of the framework, they have unresolved questions. There are puzzles connected to it that people don't yet know how to solve. So it's not looking for a package where everything's tidied up and there are no puzzles left. No, it answers everything and it has no problems. But, you know, a view of the world that seems to have fewer deep, glaring, unresolved questions or the inability to speak to certain things about the human condition, well, that's a big strike against it. And so yeah, I'd recommend, but that's a procedure that requires the kind of thing that I think Bob was trying to articulate. Repeated dialogue, where a lot of the time you're just trying to understand this other kind of view. Ask questions in a charitable way. Just help me better understand how you're thinking about these things. So that ultimately, I'm interested in saying, is this a view that I want to possibly take on?
Yeah, so I would say three things. Number one, approach every conversation as an individual, right? With an individual. So more often than not, when I am the best at speaking into someone's life about a particular thing, it's when I'm speaking into their life, emphasis on their life, right? In order to speak into their life and have that conversation, I have to know them as much as possible in order to be effective. That's the first thing. Second thing is I've got to ask more questions than I give answers. So you've always, you know, you've heard that adage, give three compliments and then a criticism, you know, something like that. In other words, to ask them questions. There's two things that happen there. It allows them to articulate something to you, their particular truth claim themselves, their belief system. It also helps them to, and they do this themselves, it helps them to see the problems and their particular perspective. And you've had that experience before, right? Somebody's asked you to explain something, and as you start to explain it, you think, oh my gosh, this doesn't sound very good. I thought it sounded all right up here, right? So you engage people in dialogue that way. It helps them even to sort of see the difficulty with their line of reasoning, right? So I would say, you know, first, address the person as a person. Second, ask questions more than you answer. And third, I would say, enter into story. So there's a book that someone wrote a number of years ago, at least 20 years ago, and it was about Jesus. And the title of the book was, He Taught Them with Stories. So think how many times Jesus or another incredible teacher teaches with stories, right? So when you enter into story, their story, you share your story with them, and you speak in the story, you're probably a lot better off in terms of making progress. Now, I hear it's the last question, but we'll hang out and ask questions individually of each other if you want.
Absolutely. You guys are definitely not off the hook yet, so please stick around. They are more than willing to, an hour or two? No, I'm kidding. to engage with you afterwards if you have questions. Please join me in thanking the panel. Coming up, we are off. There are no Trinity Fellowship events in December or January, but a big one coming up in February. It's a Veritas Forum, February 28th, with Dr. Sam Newlands of the University of Notre Dame, a philosophy professor there, offering us a little bit of hope, talking about hope in the midst of pain, suffering, and injustice. So you want to mark your calendars and be with us for that event. Again, please don't rush out. Feel free to engage the panelists and one another with your questions.
And make sure you give us your email addresses if you're interested in further updates.
Great reminder.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Have a good night.